Welcome to Opto Sessions, where we interview the brightest minds from the stock market, uncovering their secrets to success. If you're looking for ideas, tips and techniques from the world's best, you're in the right place. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Opto Sessions. I'm your host Ed Gotham and our next guest needs no introduction. But I'm going to give you one anyway. Jack Schwager, author of the hugely popular and widely acclaimed Market Wizard series. Jack is a recognized industry expert in futures and hedge funds, and more recently has also stepped into the world of entrepreneurship as a founder of Fundseeder, a platform to find talented traders and connect them with sources of capital. We dive into the Market Wizard series with special insight into the minds of prolific hedge fund wizards Ray Dalio, Stanley Druckenmiller, and Paul Tudor Jones. We close the interview by revealing some of the stories you'll want to read about his upcoming release, Unknown Market Wizards. Enjoy. Hello, Jack. It's a pleasure to finally talk to you in person. How's everything going where you are?
Pretty good.
I'd like to start with in an area, I know probably most people start the Market Wizards section with individuals, but on the investing misconceptions area, because I know you've explored that in detail with a lot of the people you've worked with. Can you possibly take us through a couple of people, misconceptions from the people you've interviewed over the years?
I guess I would just draw on personal experience on this one. And actually, I wrote a whole book called Market Sense and Nonsense, which the whole point of the whole focus of the book was on misconceptions. But let me just pick a few of them. And let's take one that just about all investors fall prey to, which is overemphasis on more recent returns. And so if you take it from, I'll take it from two standpoints, one from index funds or just general investing in the stock market, let's say, and another would be, let's say, on hedge fund performance. It's the same principle, but they're different points. So, you know, most people, if you look at where inflows go, they usually are biggest after you've had a long bull run in the markets. And if you look at what happens 10 years, 15 years, 20 years forward, and I've done the analysis, the worst performing periods come, not surprisingly, after you've had, you know, really good performance. And the best performance horizons are when the market's done really terrible. So if you look at, if you invest when the market has done really lousy for the last 5 years, the last 10 years relative to history, and I've took these numbers all the way back to the 1850s, you do best by investing for the longer term when the market has done really badly in recent years, which is the opposite of what most people do. And when you take it something like hedge funds, the interesting thing, I did a study is, not particular hedge funds, but sectors. It's like about 30 plus sectors based on HFRI. So I did a study where you took the best hedge funds of the last performance, the best sector of the last 3 or 5 years, or best 1, 3, and 5 years, and the worst 1 and 3 or 5 years performing sector. And if you looked at what happened over the future horizon, like when you invest in one of those, you found that on a return risk basis, you actually did better investing in the worst performing sector of the recent years, averaging those, the 1, 3, and 5, than if you invested in the best one. And that sounds counterintuitive, but the explanation is easy, is because the sectors that have outperformed are the ones that had a wide, it's part of reversion to the mean. They've had a wide move away from some historical norm. That's why they've outperformed. So let's say oil or something like that. If oil has a real big run, is done really, really well, oil sector, or energy sector, I should say, will be one of the top performers. Vice versa, if it's done really, really poorly. So what you end up when you're picking a particular hedge fund, you're picking one that is focused on a certain sector. The ones that perform best a lot of times are those who just happen to be in the right sector. And that's true also on stock sectors, by the way. It's not just hedge funds. So again, it's kind of counterintuitive that if you pick the best performing ones, you actually end up doing worse than average, and sometimes worse than the bet than picking the worst performing one. So that's one big misconception area. Another one, which is really pertinent to just alternative investment, is this confusion between volatility and risk. Sort of it's become almost synonymous to think of risk in terms of volatility. Now that works sometimes. If you get the stock market very, very volatile, then it's going to be more risky than periods when the stock market is fairly calm. That part of it is works. But where it doesn't work is you have investing areas or strategies which can have very low volatility, but can be very, very risky in what I call hidden risk. It's a type of risk that isn't visible all the time, but it's just sporadically on it when an event occurs, the risk shows up. So classic example, strategy, you have hedge funds a lot, or CTAs out there, lots of them. The strategy is they sell way out of the money options. And that looks great most times. It's just like a money machine until you get something like March, and then those type of strategies get decimated. And people don't realize it. They look at return or return to risk. It looks like a great return to risk. It looks like the risk is very low because the volatility is low. But the low volatility is misleading. It's low in broad periods, but then the thing that makes a low volatility, in this case, say I'm selling way out of the money options, you're not going to lose unless it's a really big event. So it looks like there's not much volatility. But if you get the event and your track record doesn't include a prior event, then you have this explosion in volatility. So the risk is there, but it's not visible if you're just using historical numbers. So that's another classic misconception.
Very interesting. And for people, I mean, a lot of people on this podcast will sort of know you already, but if you give us like a brief overview for anyone that doesn't know, but obviously quite well, very well known in this area.
Sure. It's a brief bio, it's just very short, as short as I can make it. So most people know me from the Market Wizards books. You know, there have been five, I just have the fifth one coming out. I've also written other more analytical books. I won't have to reel them off. As far as non-author type of endeavors, most of my original career was as a research analyst in futures, actually a little over 20 years as a research director in futures for firms like Smith Barney and Prudential Beige. Then I spent 10 years at a hedge fund advisory firm, and more recently I've been involved in a startup called Fundseeder. So that's kind of as brief as I can make a career, which is now years long.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you. And what were you doing as an analyst on futures, by the way?
I started, first 2 years, I was just a straight analyst, and I was analyzing markets like sugar and cotton and livestock. And then I became a research director, and I was basically responsible for all futures market research.
Okay, oh, brilliant. And what is a market wizard in your own sort of words for you?
Okay, so what I look for, a lot of when I do a search for market wizards, people get, and I, this last time around, I used social media to help for the search, and I also use Fundseeder. But if I'm using social media, people coming back and they send me, oh, I kind of make 500% last year. Well, and the track record is 1 year, and they turned 20,000 into 100,000. Okay, great. But I mean, that's not what I'm looking for. So what I'm looking for is, first of all, longer term records. I make rare exceptions, but generally, 10 years plus, 20 years plus is even better. But I'm looking for longer track records. So it's not just somebody got lucky a year or two, right? I'm looking for not just high returns, or not necessarily always high returns. So I'm looking for people who've done very well return to risk. So, and by return to risk, I'm getting into the tangent of what measures I use. I don't use the Sharpe ratio per se, but you can think in terms of something like the Sharpe ratio. And I'm looking for people who've made very, very good return while having, their drawdowns well controlled. I look more in terms of the metrics I use are more focused on losses as opposed to volatility. So I'm looking for people who've generated extremely good return relative to the losses they've taken along the way to get those returns. And sometimes it you know, in some cases where people just may have high risk as well, but if they're not really exceptional, that's enough by itself too. So like in the book, upcoming book, I have somebody who turned literally turned like $5,000 into $50 million. So,
wow.
Yeah, so that's good enough, you know. You don't have to worry too much. But the return risk is still good.
Yeah.
But it's not the exceptional return risk. In that case, it's just the exceptional multiplication of money.
And you managed to verify this through
looking at
trading accounts. Yeah.
So, in fact, this particular person came through an email to me. And my natural inclination is, yeah, sure, you know. But, you know, so what I'm saying, I'm willing to say, okay, well, you know, can you prove this? And, well, I got all the statements, so. Which is a pain because I gotta get up, like, reams of monthly statements.
And
Excel sheets. But, yeah, I can't take these numbers on face value.
Yeah.
And there are traders. Now, this particular person, I forget the returns. What they worked out here, they were triple digit probably. But this is a longer record. This goes back to like almost 20 years. But I had some traders who had more like 10, 12 year records. And I had two traders in the book who had, for the, over that period, unbelievably like 300% annual returns, you know,
consistently.
So numbers like that, you have to get statements because they just are not believable.
Yeah. And so they must be using some sort of leverage.
Well, they were very aggressive. These particular two traders I'm thinking of are extremely aggressive, but not all the time, just particular points in time. They just pick their shots. They're extraordinarily good in picking their shots. And when they do, they go in very heavy. And they're very, very good at getting out extremely quickly if they're not right.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. And I thought to go and talk about Ray Dalio now, which is obviously one of the people that you've interviewed in the Market Wizard series. So obviously Ray Dalio is the illustrious founder of Bridgewater Associates, one of the most successful hedge funds of all time, having generated over $57.8 billion for investors, probably the most well-known hedge fund investor nowadays. The funds at Bridgewater are completely fundamentally based and apply a systematic approach to fund management. I think he's quoted, or your quote in your book is 99% of decisions made by a computer, using no technical signals and inputs to their models at all. Can you describe this sort of approach in more detail and why you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's rather extraordinary for me because I did not think, well, two things that are extraordinary about Bridgewater. Is one, I did think it would be totally impossible for a hedge fund to manage the types of assets they manage and be able to do it without getting in their own way. It is extraordinary that they have had such good results with such enormous amount of money. Bridgewater is by no means the best, anywhere near the best return fund or the best return risk fund, but nobody comes close in terms of having made money for investors because of the enormous amounts of money they manage with good performance stats. So that's one way they're unbelievable. The other way is I would have thought that, and I in my career have used both fundamental and technical analysis, and I never was able to make fundamental. One problem I had fundamental analysis, I couldn't make it work timing wise. So I'm surprised that, you know, one could actually build such a successful fund where it's really based on fundamentals and trading, which should depend on timing. So what do they do? Well, of course, you know, give you the cookbook, but essentially, the key to what they do, I can say there's two things that they do. One is, Ray Dalio, if he is anything, is an historian. So I think in the book I have a line like, what do you call an analysis of the market from the whole entire post-World War II period from Dalio's perspective? And I think my line was myopic. because his, I mean, that is almost short. That's not shorter, but it's more shorter. He will literally go back hundreds of years or as far as data can go. And so there are markets that may have occurred, let's say, in the 1800s, that, or even the, you know, first half of the 20th century, people will not have any knowledge or factor that in. But Dalio knows those markets, and so that's all factored in. And he, one of the things that he does, because he's such a student of history, is to divide markets into different types of markets. Let's say a market where there's inflation and growth, or is a different type of market where there's no inflation and growth. So his point is that any given fundamental input will behave differently depending on the category of market. So one of the things he's done through his knowledge of history is to categorize different types of markets by combinations, say, of stuff, or things like inflation and growth, also by monetary policy. So he may look at countries like, if a country's a creditor nation or a debtor nation, and does it control its own currency or doesn't it? Different combinations of those, again, are different, and the same fundamental factor will affect those combinations differently. So that's one of the things that go into that model, is it's not all the same. The same fundamental will have different implications in different countries and in different combinations of prevailing macro trends. So that's one big element. Another element is that defines who Dalio is and what he's made Bridgewater is this emphasis on learning from mistakes. So whenever something doesn't work, there's all sorts of analysis of why it didn't work and how can the model be changed, not to make it work in that particular instance, but what can we learn? What did we miss out of that? What mistake did we make? What wasn't in the model that we can learn? So throughout this whole career of 40 years plus, he's constantly revising the model to learn the things that were missing that show up because something doesn't work. So that's another big element of what makes up that model.
Do you remember any examples of mistakes he's used to as a new input to his model? Nothing comes to mind.
Well, just like from his own personal experience, I think the beginning of the bull market, it was around 82, the stock market. And there was some bearish news that came out. It was a big bearish news item. I forget what it was. And he came in thinking, well, boy, the market's going to get killed. And he went short. And not only did it get killed, not only did it go up, but that was the beginning of a long-term bull market. This fundamental fact that he thought would affect the market one way, in a certain environment, could affect it the other way. That was a specific, had a major impact on him. And also the knowledge that the timing of fundamental news can actually, if the market's behaving in a inverse way, can itself be a major signal.
Yeah. And I believe I've read bits of his book, Principles, as well. And one of the other things that he has, believability weighted decisions. So he never trusts his opinion totally and validates it by getting the opinions of other people he trusts to see if they have similar ideas or if it contradicts. And then, you know, he can go and test his idea to see how likely it is to be right. And I believe that's something else he's integrated into the culture at Bridgewater. Is there any other notable things?
Yeah, it's part of our culture to challenge any ideas or to, you know, how can I be wrong type, being open to being wrong, being proven wrong.
Yeah. Are there any other parts of the culture that you think were important as well?
Well, I imagine, well, the culture is part of this learning from mistakes and part of everybody kind of being able to call somebody else out. So, I think that's part of it. It's he creates an environment where anybody can be challenged, including himself. And so people are not only not discouraged from speaking out, but are encouraged to, if they have something to contribute.
And he's almost also famous. Well, the fund is also famous for having zero correlation to traditional markets and a low correlation to other hedge funds, which is based around this theory that return risk ratio improves by holding uncorrelated assets. Are you able to just touch on sort of Ray's commitment to?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly diversification is, he's a, you know, Dalio is a great believer in diversification. He likes to draw this graph. In fact, when I was interviewing him, he went to his blackboard and drew this graph about how, you know, how the risk comes down with the more uncorrelated assets you have and how big that down curve is. So he's definitely a big believer in it. There's no question. I mean, it's almost a mathematical truism that's correct. The tough part is doing it. And I did ask him how he does it and how do you manage it when assets become correlated. And basically, the point is that a lot of their so-called assets are not single assets, but they're one asset versus the other. So, for example, the behavior of Scandinavian bonds versus European bonds or a specific country in Scandinavia versus a specific country in Europe, that bond, that main, while each of those bonds may itself be correlated to other main markets, the ratio of those bonds to each other, or the relay, or the spread difference between each other, that may not be correlated. So a lot of what they do is they get paired assets, or I would assume maybe even more than two assets as a so-called single investment. And that particular combination may have low correlation, even if each leg of it may be correlated to other markets. So that's part of the way they achieve it.
Yeah.
I think an important part.
Another person you interviewed, I believe in one of the earlier books, was Stanley Druckenmiller.
Yeah.
And obviously notorious American hedge fund founder, famous among other things for shorting the British pound whilst working for George Soros at the Quantum Fund. That's rumored to have earned $1 billion, I believe, in profit just from that single trade. Can you describe Stanley's top-down sort of investing approach?
Yeah, so as opposed to like a type of hedge fund that will, you know, buy and really focus in on individual stocks and do a lot of that. He may have individual stocks, but his big thing is to get the main market trend. So he learned early in his career, where he started out as a long-only analyst or a long-only portfolio manager for somebody else. And he found that was a big handicap, having to always be long. And when he started his own fund, he got bearish, I think, early on. And he went 50%. He brought his long down to 50% long. But he still lost money on that 50%. And he learned from that point on, well, why even keep 50%? If I'm really, really super bearish, why have anything long? So his primary thing is to get the main market direction. So if it's stocks or bonds or specific currencies or, I guess, specific commodities even. And then, I mean, he will do some other fine-tuning and he'll have maybe individual stocks. But the most important thing is to get the big trend right. So this top-down investing, that's what it means by top-down. It's more getting the main market direction right, and then you can supplement it by individual stock analysis.
Yeah, interesting. And Stanley's famous for saying, the way to build superior long-term returns is through preservation of capital and home runs. You can be far more aggressive when making good profits.
Yeah, so Druckenmiller's, one of his big things is, and he quotes, and I forget if it's Druckenmiller's original line, but I think he quoted Soros here.
Yeah.
And I think what he's saying, what he learned from Soros was it takes, and paraphrasing or quoting Soros, it takes courage to be a pig. And by that he means when he's he tells a story in the interview where he got really, really bullish on a D-mark, and he had like $1 billion, you know, he went to George Soros and tell him, and he was at that point working for Soros, Soros had hired him. And this was while Soros and Druckenmiller were still working, investing at the same time. And there was some headbutting there as well, not because they were different in approaches, but just two different personalities. And not long after Soros, the Berlin Wall came down, and Soros went off to Eastern Europe to try to help foster democracies in Eastern Europe, and left Druckenmiller to run the shop. But this was at the point where Druckenmiller and Soros were there together, and he went into Soros, and he was pitching him on why he was so bullish on the D-mark. And Soros asked him, well, what's your position? He says, $1 billion. And Soros said to him dismissively, $1 billion? You call that a position? Meaning that if you're that bullish, why do you only have $1 billion on? And that position was immensely right. And Druckenmiller, you know, they pushed it to like $2 or $3 billion after that. But he kind of learned that the way to really have a really, really good long-term track record is those times where you're right, really right, or have high conviction, you really have to step on the accelerator. He also talks about, you know, if he's a year, he's up like 30 or 40%, most hedge funds will then typically will kind of be very cautious. I'll try to protect that big profit. They'll nibble at things. Druckenmiller's view is, hey, you got a 30, 40% cushion. That's when you really have the ammunition to go big if you've got the right trade.
Yeah.
And go for the 100% year. So because he's able to get some of these really big return years, he's able to come out with a long-term, I think his horizon is plus 40 years. But this ended the hedge fund he ran, his own hedge fund, which he ran continually, called the Duquesne Fund, until he closed it some years ago. I believe he compounded it, you know, for over 30 years at over 30%. I don't remember the exact numbers, but wow, that's good. That's close enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of that is because he had some really big years. So he could take a year where he was down 5% or something like that, because he has those really big years to offset and still end up with a plus 30% compounded return.
What's your opinion on that? Is it like, I mean, mathematically, is it better to have those massive winning years and a few, because I think he's famous saying, like, yeah, like you said, you know, some years where he makes zero, he might be up and then comes back because he's gone big. But then he's got those huge home runs when he does hit them. Is that better than being consistent at 20%?
Yeah, it's better if you're comfortable with that type of approach. Look, the market, this goes to another concept. Yeah, this idea of consistent, and that's it's one of the themes in my new book, Undiscovered Market Wisdom, that comes up a number of times in a number of interviews, interestingly. But it's the idea that, you know, that consistency, looking at being a consistent trader, while that sounds really good, it's in many ways a misconception, because the markets, as one trader said, I think it was Peter Brand said, the markets are not an annuity. They're not going to give you a consistent, equal-spaced string of opportunities. There could be months where there's nothing, and then there could be, in fact, one trader said, hey, like last year, I made all my returns in 2 weeks in December and one day in July. 100% of my returns came from that. So that's what the markets are. There are points where there are real big opportunities, and there are points where there's nothing. And so it's important. So if you can do it, it's good to be able to do both. One, to really take advantage of the opportunities if you've got the confidence and the skill. And secondly, not to do anything in the times where there's no opportunities. And so people who are trying to get consistency, the reason why that's bad is it'll encourage people to put on trades that are suboptimal, because, hey, you know, I gotta make $10,000 this month. I got a mortgage to pay, right? And I haven't made anything yet. So they're looking for anything, even if the trade isn't there. So it's not a good idea to look for consistency. You know, you gotta take what the market gives you. Mm. You can't dictate to the market what you want. Yep. The market doesn't care what you want. You know, it's.
Yeah, yeah. And the other point you made in that quote I mentioned earlier was the preservation of capital. Obviously, trading the risk of trading size is that if it's the wrong call, you have large losses. How does Stanley approach sort of risk management?
So I don't recall, so the interview with Stanley was quite a while ago. It was in, I believe, it was Newmarket Research, which came out, I think 92 or so. So it's quite a while ago. I don't remember him going in too much into what his risk control is, except what came out of that interview is what was his incredible flexibility to change his mind when he's wrong.
Yeah.
So he's not only the type of person that can will get out very quickly when he realizes he's wrong, but he'll even reverse his position. And there was a classic story in that interview about the 87 crash, which if you want, I can go into. But
yeah, of course. Yeah, I think this is a nice example.
This, and maybe this explains really how he controls risk as well. In 87, he was with Dreyfus, and he was managing like seven different funds for Dreyfus. And he was bullish early in the year, for the first part of the year. And then about mid-year, he turned bearish. And that was a good move, because the market did begin selling off. And then there was one day, in 1 week in October, where the market went down really sharply in the first half of October. And that Friday, the Dow, I think it was the Dow, come down to like something like 2,200. And it was a week, the market was very weak after several months of being down. And Stan looked at it and he said, well, there should be support here. And remember, he came in short. And he thought, well, this is a reasonable place to take profits. So he took profits that Friday. But not only did he take profits, he thought that the market would get a technical bounce. So he went long. And in fact, he went leveraged long. And that Friday was October 16th, 1987, which will mean something to people who were around then, or people who know a little bit of stock market history. But anyway, over that weekend, and this was before the big October 19th crash. So over the weekend, and this is tangential, why? But he realized that he was wrong. For multiple reasons, he realized it came to him that he had made a mistake. So he had every intention of covering his position Monday morning. The only problem was that over... By the time, you know, the markets crashed in Europe first, and by the time U.S. opened, the markets opened down like gap like 10% lower. So now, if you the interesting, and then of course, on that day, October 19th, the market went down in the U.S. and based on stock market, never the tape never caught it up, but based on futures, I think it was down something like 27 to 29%, exact number in one day. And so there was the biggest decline ever. And it's just extraordinary decline. Now, if you look at Stanley's performance in October of that year, he was barely down. And so how can you reverse from long from short to leverage long on October 16th and end up not losing much? I mean, it seems impossible. Well, this part of the answer is he was short the first half of the month, so he did make money then. But the key to it was he knew he was wrong. So what does he do Monday morning? Immediately, he not only covers that entire position, 10% down or 12% down, whatever the market was when it opened, he actually reversed back to short. So that just gives you an idea. To me, that's the most incredible display of trader flexibility that I ever came across in my life. But the ability to do that, and very, very few people could do something like that. The ability to do that is how he manages risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great example. And I've got a final quote here. He says, you can't win when you have to win, which relates to a story early on in his career when he made a desperate attempt to save his firm from financial ruin. Can you sort of describe what he means here?
Yeah, so he had just started his hedge fund. He didn't have that much on. He had a few million under assets. His overhead for the office and for his assistant and whatever, his overhead for the year was like $150,000. His management fees were only like $30,000 on what he was managing. What he was really depending on, he has one important consulting client. I think it was a firm called Drysdale Securities, whatever. And one day they blew up for whatever reason. So he lost his consulting client. And so he had a gap between his operating expenses and the money he was drawing in. At the same time, this is, I think, 82, the same time, this was when interest rates were really, really sky high. He was looking for, you know, a peak in interest rates and a beginning of a bull market in bonds and bills and euros and so forth, eurodollars. And so what he did was he was very convinced that we were near a turning point. And so he just put the whole fund's investment into, I believe it was eurodollars. And the irony, of course, this was a move of desperation. And he sort of was trying to save the firm. But he had to win. Now, the irony, now, 4 days later, the market went down some more, and he blew out of that, you know, he was blown out of that position. Now, shortly after that, the market turned around and started what is now almost a 40-year bull market. You know, you could argue we're still in it, unless we've just peaked out recently, you know. So he almost at the bottom of like a 35, 40-year bull market. He almost had it to within a week. But because he had to bet everything at once and he had to win and he couldn't allow himself, he had no leeway, he lost. And it's the idea, you know, one of the things I always say to people is don't invest or don't trade if you can't afford to lose. If you need the money for a mortgage, I don't care if you're the world's greatest trader, you're going to lose. It's just too much of a burden. I mean, trading is hard enough, but if you have to win, yep, you can't win.
That's great. Great quote. And now the third wizard that I wanted to turn to was Paul Tudor Jones, billionaire founder of the hedge fund Tudor, who shot to fame in the 80s when he successfully predicted the Black Monday crash in 1987. How would you describe Paul's trading strategy, if you could sum that up, if you remember from your...
Sure. And again, I interviewed Paul quite a while ago. And, you know, after I interviewed him, went on to start Tudor Investments and expand it, and was managing, I guess, tens of billions at one point. I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't kept up with him totally. So I don't know, you know, his personal trading probably remained the same, but I can't guarantee.
Yes.
I certainly the hedge fund would have lots of different strategies. But the way he personally traded was, he's kind of the opposite of I would say it's the opposite of a trend follower, even though he believes in trends, but it's the opposite of trend follower. He would like to probe like that stock market crash, which he caught in 87. He thought the market was going to top. So he was probing for a short position. And that's the way he likes to trade. And he explains that as, if you're going to go into a market when it's already trending, you're going in the middle of a trend, and you're trying to catch it, then if you're going to use a stop, a protective stop, which you should, you got to use a wide stop, or it's not going to be meaningful. You know, you're going to have pullbacks in a trend that don't mean anything. But when you're probing, when you think the market is at a top or a bottom, and you're trying to probe for it, you don't have to have too much room to get a meaningful stop. So that's his argument is, that you can try to get these market turns, and you can have many. You can take a lot of swings because it doesn't. You don't have to allow very much to show that particular trade is just too early. You know, it's just not yet. So that was his approach. You know, I assume he probably carried on, which was to try to get situations where he was looking for a major bottom or a major top, and if he's, you know, and to use relatively close stops and to keep doing it until he got it. If he was wrong a lot, then he would just reduce his position size. But essentially, that was his favorite type of trade, would be to try to identify the markets that he thought were overextended, ready for a peak or a bottom, and to probe for those spots at the right times.
Yep. And that goes in line with, I've got a quote here. He says, to be a good trader, you have to be a contrarian. Pretty much in line with what you're saying, I think. He's looking.
Yeah, I mean, that's so it was that contrarian approach to him. And I've got one trader in this new book who's even more who was 100% the contrary, you know, so which is interesting. I mean, just totally, totally lives and breathes being a contrarian.
Also, what's amazing to me is how there's room for a lot of different approaches to work. Because obviously you get the trend followers as well, who do well. The contrarians, when they time it right, it's people find their sort of niche that works for them.
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't know if you, I'm hoping you can explain this. He has a trading rule: don't ever average losers. Do you know what that means in practice? And
yeah, I mean, that's, let me make a distinction here. It's okay to scale down into a position if that was pre-planned. That's really the distinction. So if you want to buy a market, it doesn't make a difference. Say a market that's trading at 50 and you want to buy it, if it dips down because you think it's going to go up, you want to buy it if it dips down to 45 to 42 area, and you get a reaction and you buy at 45, you buy at 44, you buy at 43, you buy at 42 with some sort of pre-planned exit, right? Stops below, somewhere below 42. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But what the quotation you're using refers to is, okay, you buy the market, same market, it's 50, goes down to 45, you buy it, and that's where you think the bottom is going to be. And then it goes down to 44 and you buy more, and then because you want to get your price lower. And it wasn't pre-planned. You're just trying to lower your average. You say, okay, I'm behind now, but if I buy some more here, my price will be lower. It'll be easier for me to bounce back. That's what's wrong, because what happens with that is you don't have the pre-planned exit. You can then end up having one trade blow up the whole account. So that's the problem with averaging down, not in that respect, is that you're trying to make it easier to recover, but if you're wrong on a trade and you don't have an exit plan, you could really lose a lot on one trade.
Yep, yep. Now that's a very key lesson. Knowing your risk basically is a big thing there, isn't it? And not hoping that the way you want it to go is what's going to happen. So that hope is not a strategy sort of approach. So I've got some here that Paul believes best money is made at the market turns, which we've already sort of discussed. He mentions that Elliott waves have been key to his success in this. Is that something you can touch on? Or,
well, yeah, I mean, reason Elliott wave, and I'm no Elliott, you know, Elliott wave is nothing, anything that I particularly gravitated towards, although the concept kind of makes sense and markets have some sort of behavior. The problem I always Elliott wave is defining them, you know, they always seem to, and if you look at people who used Elliott waves, a lot of times they would say, oh, well, what I thought was this wave was really this wave, and it keeps getting redefined. So I personally am not a proponent of it, but there are people who use it successfully. And like, my attitude is anything that works for you, whether it makes sense or not, I don't care. Then that's fine. If it works, good. Now for Paul, the reason why that worked is because he liked to look for stops to pick tops. So Elliott wave was one tool. So if it's the third wave and the third wave extends to a certain price, and there's some other reasons to believe maybe there's some other resistance at that point or some other targets at that point, or there's some fundamentals that suggest the market should turn, whatever, then the Elliott wave combined with some other stuff becomes one of the tools to identify a potential top or bottom. So that's why Paul Tudor Jones used it, because it works well if your strategy, it not works well, but it is amenable, I should say. It is amenable to a strategy that is looking for entry at tops, to pick tops and bottoms based on anticipated areas of market reversal.
One of the fundamental rule Paul has, I've read from your book, is buy, don't sell the breakout. If there is, he mentions that if there is a sudden range expansion in a market that has been trading narrowly, human nature is to try to fade that price move. When you get a range expansion, the market is sending you a very loud, clear signal that the market is getting ready to move in the direction of that expansion. Why do you think human nature is to try and fade moves like that?
Yeah, because think about it. Let's say you have a market in a long-term range and then you have a big breakout to a new high. And a lot of times, a lot of times those may be false breakouts and, you know, go down. But there's a temptation. The reason why there's a temptation to go short that is because you sell there. And guess what? At that moment, you're smarter than anybody who shorted the market anywhere in that whole period of that trend. You got the highest point the market's been at for that entire period. So people do what feels good. And so if you're putting on a position where that's the best entry for some period of time, then, well, you know, I got the best entry for some period. That's a temptation. I think that's why people do it. Now, you do get false breakouts. So you can actually, you could even argue that you could have a strategy where somebody does that and they have a way of getting out quickly if they're wrong, whatever. Now, Paul, I would emphasize there, thinking that the quote you got there, he's talking about a range expansion. So it's not merely a breakout, because you get a lot of false breakouts. Not so much, much more so now than when I interviewed him. But he's talking about a particular type of breakout. It's not only the market's breaking out, but it's having a big move. It's like trading in a certain range, and then it breaks out on a much wider range. So that's what he was referring to.
And he's saying there that, so you could say, it's almost like this new all-time highs sort of, it's a bullish move, basically. It's a positive signal to...
He's saying if you get the breakout and the range expansion, more often than not, that's the market's telling you that it's going to have another move.
And we say, when we say range expansion, just to confirm, it's a big move in a certain direction.
Yeah, think of it as a bar that's much bigger. I call it a wide-ranging day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's brilliant, Jack. If we could talk about your new book now, that'd be great. Or just a little introduction for people. We're going to have obviously another podcast later on, closer to the release date. I think it's still about a month until it comes out. Obviously available for pre-order at the moment. It'd be great to talk about that if you could describe it.
Sure. So the book is called Undiscovered Market Wizards. Unknown Market Wizards. And I was actually going between those two titles. That's why so it's Unknown Market Wizards. And as the title suggests, the idea this a lot of times the people I interviewed were well known, like people like Ray Dalio, right? Paul Tudor Jones, even when I interviewed him, he wasn't anything as widely known as he ultimately became, but at least he had established a number of years of good performance and he was known to some extent. A lot of the past interviews were with people like that, and sometimes with people who were not known. And the book before this, the Market Wizard people before this, was Hedge Fund Market Wizards, where they were all known because they were all managing hedge funds. So this time, I wanted to go the other way. I wanted to go to just people who were completely unknown. Really, I was looking for solo traders, not managing money, doing phenomenally, nobody knows they exist, that type of thing. Now, except one person in the book, there's a little bit of an exception because over recent years, he started blogging and sort of built up a wide following. So he's known in that sector, but he never managed money. And so he's still not known like a hedge fund manager or whatever. But essentially, I was looking for, and he still was always like a solo trader. So that's what I was looking for. I was looking for the solo traders who are just doing their own thing, doing phenomenally, and nobody knows they exist. And the premise was that there are people out there that nobody knows, that are just trading for themselves, that are doing better than the vast majority of professional managers. And I'm talking about hedge fund managers, not. So, and that also ties in a little bit to this concept of fund seeder, where the concept of fund seeder is that it's a platform for traders, and the idea is that we would find traders who would link their accounts that were doing better than professional managers by trying to go globally. And indeed, I think you have like three or four of the traders from the book did come through front seat. So there are people who just like, wow.
Yeah.
You would never know them. You know, they're just kind of trading their own account.
Yeah. And they're trading quite a large size.
Not necessarily. I wasn't looking for, in some cases, they were trading, in some cases, these people ended up being The people in the book ended up people who were trading tens of millions, but only because they had started out with small amounts and built it up, but not because. But there was the classic example is a person in the book who never, and I put him in the book without hesitation, even though his account was always between 50 to 100,000, which seems trivial, and why would he be in the book? Well, the reason in the book is this particular fellow, he's an ex-bellhop in Czechoslovakia, never had any money, started trading. I lost the first 6 months and I came back, but developed a methodology. He's one of the people I got off the front seater. So whenever I looked at the top 10 people or whatever, he's always in there. And you look at his return chart, and it's like one of those mountain charts, you know, just goes steadily up. You know, every now and then a little dip. But we know it's real because we're getting, because he's a linked account, the returns come from the broker and not from him. So I knew it was real. So the story basically is, I mean, I found out that basically bellhop had no money. And the reason why the account's always 1,500, because for the last 15 years, he's been living, he makes, you know, he's got a $50,000, $60,000 account. He makes $50,000 or whatever, $40,000 a year, lives off of it. So his account never grows because he's living off the money he's making. But he's trading large cap stocks. And the reason was because he figured if he ever made it, he didn't want to have to change his strategy. So the guy literally could be managing hundreds of millions or even a billion on the strategy. But he only has, nobody knows him. He's, like I say, an ex-bellhop living in a little village, a village of like 1,000 people in Czechoslovakia. You know, yeah, so I'm saying, so the fact is, now if he was like trading sort of like these micro stock, nobody, okay, now I wouldn't have concluded it, but he was trading stocks that, you know, super, you know, mega stocks. He's developed a methodology that kind of really has outstanding return to risk. And for people from, I don't use a sharp, but in terms of, if you looked at a sharp, it would be like 3 or 4 or something like that over the time period.
That's incredible. And it's, obviously we'll dig into this in a lot more detail. But if we could just sum up, to give people a little bit of an insight about the book, what do you reckon the main difference between professional managers are and the people you saw, you know, these people, unknown market wizards? Was there one sort of characteristic you think that allowed them to do well, even though they didn't have that sort of professional, or was it?
Yeah, no, not one characteristic. It's like in all the books, there are multiple characteristics that people share. The method, which are, and none of them have to do with methodology, because the methodology is always end up being, everybody's different. Yep. But they're all, you know, but almost invariably, they'll have a strong emphasis on risk management. They'll find an approach that kind of really resonates with what their innate beliefs and skills are, which is why the methodologies are always different, because everybody has a different skill or edge or interest. They'll have the ability to, you know, they have real edges in their approaches, such that they can have situations where their trade, whatever it may be for their methodology, sets up and they have very high conviction that's a good trade. So they share the character. There are lots of others. They share those types of characteristics for the most part.
Brilliant. Well, it's pretty exciting. I'm really excited to read it. Where can people find you, Jack? Where if they want to?
Okay, so, you know, so as far as websites go, my website is jackschwager.com, just my name.com. Fundseeder is Fundseeder, just like it sounds, FundSeeder.com. And, you know, the books are all available, obviously, on Amazon. You know, search my name on Amazon or Market Wizards on Amazon or whatever. They're also on my website, but, you know.
And it's about a month, is it, till the book comes out, but you can still pre-order it now.
Official publication date is November 3rd. And so the the print copy, the ebook, and the audio all will come out around that,
brilliant,
that date.
Well, thanks very much, Jack. Really appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Cool. Have a good one. Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Just a quick note before we sign off. If you're looking for an easily digestible daily update on the markets, this might be of interest to you. Opto Updates is our short newsletter sent every day during a trading week, giving you a bulleted list of the top 7 stories from the global stock markets. We've done the hard work for you, highlighting relevant opportunities and trends, and in addition, we'll also keep you notified of any new podcasts, stock reports, or events from the Opto world. If you're interested, sign up using the link in the show notes. Until next time. Jack Schwager, author of the hugely popular and widely acclaimed Market Wizard series. Jack is a recognized industry expert in futures and hedge funds, and more recently has also stepped into the world of entrepreneurship as a founder of Fundseeder. We dive into the Market Wizard series with special insight into the minds of prolific hedge fund wizards Ray Dalio, Stanley Druckenmiller, and Paul Tudor Jones.
Dalio is a great believer in diversification. He likes to draw this graph about how risk comes down with the more uncorrelated assets you have, how big that down curve is. So he's definitely a big believer in it. It's almost a mathematical truism that that's correct. The tough part is doing it.
We close the interview by revealing some of the stories you'll want to read about his upcoming release, Unknown Market Wizards. Enjoy. Enjoy.